become synonymous with high energy physics. So, and that accounts for the first part of my talk and my title. This accounts for the big experiment. However, it's natural to ask in this day and age, why would I also be talking about small scale experiments, tabletop, for example, experiments, as probes of fundamental physics? And there are three reasons for this. One is theoretical, that there are several theoretical ideas and particles that simply cannot be tested, whose existence cannot be tested in colliders. An example of this is the graviton, but there are several other examples that we'll get to that involve physics beyond the standard model that can only be seen by different experiments, low energy, large distance experiments. The second motivation is experimental. There have been incredible advances in experimental physics in all kinds of subfields. For example, atomic physics, molecular physics, optical physics, and lots more. And there has been emerging over the last 25 or so years a new frontier, which can be called the precision frontier. A classic example of this now is atomic clocks. Atomic clocks can keep time with a 17 decimal precision, and this immediately leads to some testing some of the more wild ideas of physics. It goes back to Dirac, the time variation of fundamental constants. If you have two atomic clocks that you can that are made out of different atoms, then if they remain synchronous to 17 decimal, let's say over a year or over 10 years, then you're putting severe constraints on time variations of fundamental constants. So that's just an example. We'll talk about many more in this talk. Very interesting ideas that you can test with the new experimental technique. So instead of going to high energy, you go to high precision, and once you start measuring interesting things to 18 decimals, even small deviations beyond the standard model can manifest themselves. And the next reason is sociological. And that, I think, is very important. A young person entering the field today has about 40 to 50 years of physics ahead of them. This is a very long time. Nevertheless, they will be fortunate to see one big accelerator that goes significantly above the energy of the Large Hadron Collider. So the time scale between accelerators now has evolved to be decades, maybe three decades. So it is very important to keep these young people in the field, to keep them relevant, happy, and productive, to expand their horizons and look for fundamental physics beyond colliders. So that will be the second part of my talk now. Here is the outline. So in the beginning, I'll talk about big experiments, and that will be exclusively the LHC, and I'll talk about what we have learned from the LHC so far, some of the things we've learned from the LHC so far, and then I'll switch and talk about small experiments. Now, the main motivation for, as you know, we have something called the standard model in physics, which is exceedingly successful theory. The very first extremely important thing that the LHC has done is to discover the final component of the standard model, the so-called Higgs particle. So now the standard model seems to be consistent with all known data. So one can reasonably ask, why do we bother going beyond the standard model? And in part, the motivation is aesthetic. One of the key motivations is the so-called hierarchy problem that I would like to spend a couple of minutes reviewing. And the hierarchy problem is simply the based on the observation that if you look at the forces between a proton and the electron, the gravitational force is 40 orders of magnitude smaller than the electric force. This is an amazing fact that drives a lot of the physics beyond the standard model. And it's ironic that it is still a question. This is a question that a child would have asked. For example, the very fact that I'm able to hold this glass of water here is a true miracle, because the atomic forces, the electrical forces from my tiny fingers can hold this glass of water and overcome the gravitational attraction of the entire planet Earth. This can only be explained because of the much, much stronger intrinsic strength of electricity relative to gravity, and it is still a question that we have not. We don't know the answer to. We have several ideas, but those ideas is precisely what will be tested at the Large Hadron Collider. So the hierarchy problem can be also be stated in a different, somewhat more familiar way, as the disparity, the 16 order of magnitude disparity between two scales, the Planck mass and the weak interaction scale, which can be derived by taking the intrinsic strengths of gravity and of weak interaction. And the great disparity between the weak scale and Planck scale is another mystery. And it's a mystery for two reasons. One is, why is the scale 16 order of magnitude different? And the mystery becomes even stronger when you consider the following fact, that even if you start with a theory, you write down, let's say, a Hamiltonian, the theory, which has two scales that are very different, then quantum mechanical corrections in general will tend to pull these scales together. And the weak scale will be pulled up to the Planck scale, and then the weak interactions in such a theory would be as weak as gravity. Very different world than we know today. So one of the outstanding problems is to prevent this from happening. And there is a variety of ideas. For this lecture, I will focus just on a single idea called supersymmetry, or the supersymmetric standard model. There are other ideas involving extra dimensions, compositeness, that I won't have time to talk about. Okay, so here is the Higgs particle. The most important particle that defines the weak interaction scale is the Higgs particle, and the Higgs mass I will essentially identify with the weak interaction scale, and now we know it to be about 100 GeV. So when you take into account quantum mechanical corrections to the Higgs mass coming, for example, through its interactions with the top quark, you find that the corrections to the Higgs mass are proportional to the Planck mass. So the Higgs would like to be as heavy as the Planck scale, as we said before. And there are two ways to avoid this disaster. One is to just do a trick, namely say that the Higgs particle has a classical mass in the Lagrangian, in the Hamiltonian, that is negative in sign and almost exactly equal to the Planck mass squared, to a precision of 32 decimal places. That is called a fine-tuning problem. It is not a very appealing situation. It may be the way things are. There is no logical contradiction with having two quantities be equal to a precision of 32 decimals. Nevertheless, it's aesthetically unappealing. And that is the problem that we like to avoid. And when we talk about a natural theory or naturalness, we're talking about theories where we avoid these very precise cancellations of between large quantities, two large quantities giving you a small one. So so the option that instead has been pursued over the last 35 years was to find new theories, new dynamics or new symmetries that can protect the Higgs from becoming heavy. And the idea that I'll focus on is, of course, the supersymmetry. Now, there is a very close historical precedent for having a new symmetry to protect the mass of an elementary particle. It goes back to the late 1800s physicists back then, Abraham and Lorentz in particular, were very concerned about the mass of the electron. And their concern, of course, was based on the fact that the electron has an electric field around it, and the electric field carries energy. And if you compute the amount of energy that you carry, you would find infinity, linearly divergent infinity, 1 over some minimum size. That if you say that, well, the minimum size has to be at least as big as the Planck length, then you obtain that the mass of the electron should be of the order of the Planck mass, very heavy. So this was the old puzzle from the 1900s. And the puzzle continued, in fact, after the invention of quantum mechanics. The same problem appears in non-relativistic quantum mechanics with the electron mass. Again, you compute the electron self-energy, you find it would be of the order of the cutoff, the highest mass scale in the theory. Now, things improve tremendously once you introduce relativity. So the moment you introduce Lorentz invariance, then Lorentz invariance forces you to introduce another set of particles, the antiparticles of the electron. And in the presence, therefore, of the antiparticle of the electron, the theory gets enlarged, okay, because of Lorentz symmetry. And it starts having some other symmetries or approximate symmetries that's called chiral symmetry. It's essentially a consequence of Lorentz symmetry for spin a half particles. So in that case, Lorentz symmetry can help improve the situation with respect to the electron mass. Diagrammatically, this improvement happens because in addition to the electron loop contributing to the self-energy, there is a positron loop, and the two loops are equal to each other. The biggest contribution are equal to each other, but opposite in sign. And the first correction to the electron mass is, in fact, proportional to the electron mass times the fine structure constant times some other factor. But they are small. They are smaller than the electron mass itself that we started with. This now looks like an accidental cancellation. Of course, it is ensured by the symmetry I told, Lorentz symmetry or chiral symmetry, ensures that the corrections to the electron mass have to be proportional to the mass itself, because if the mass of the electron was exactly zero, it would stay zero by this symmetry. Now, the idea of using supersymmetry to protect the mass of the Higgs is essentially identical to the idea of using Lorentz invariance to protect the electron mass. And at least in spirit, the mathematics is a bit different. So the new symmetry called supersymmetry is unique in the sense that it relates fermions and bosons, or fermions and bosons. So a supersymmetry, no, ordinary symmetries rotate, for example, the X into the Y axis. Ordinary rotational symmetry. In supersymmetry, you rotate a boson into a fermion. So it's like a fermionic rotation. Okay? So in that sense, it's unique. And in the presence, if supersymmetry was a completely exact symmetry of the world, then two things would be true. Number one, for every particle that we know, there should be a corresponding particle of different spin. So for every fermion, there should be a boson and vice versa. And number two, the mass of the fermion and the boson that are formed together a pair of super partners, would be degenerate. Okay, so here is how the world would look like if it was supersymmetric. So for every lepton, there would be a supersymmetric partner, like the electron would have a partner which is called the selectron, the quark. The top quark has a super partner that is called the stop. It's very important for the hierarchy problem. The photon has the force particles, like photon has photino, etc., and gluon has gluino. Now, clearly, this identification makes it obvious that supersymmetry cannot be an exact symmetry of nature, because we do not have a scalar particle with the charge of the electron and the mass of the electron. So it is clear that it has to be broken. So the mass of the mass of the superpartner of a standard model particle are not, it has to differ by an amount which is called the supersymmetry breaking mass or the supersymmetry breaking scale. So the superpartners of ordinary particles have masses separated by a quantities of this of m sus squared. Now, in supersymmetric theory, with a broken supersymmetry at this scale m sus, the computation of the Higgs mass changes drastically. The quantum corrections to the Higgs mass, in addition to the top contribution, have a contribution from the superpartner of the top, the stop. These two contributions almost completely cancel, except for effects that involve the breaking of supersymmetry. So if the theory was supersymmetric, this cancellation would be total, but because of supersymmetry breaking, there's some leftover. And this makes it clear that since the mass of the Higgs is of the order of 100 GeV or so, the mass, the supersymmetry breaking scale should also be of the order of 100 GeV or so. So the supersymmetry breaking scale should be of the order of the weak interaction scale. And this was the idea. This dates back to 1981. It's a very old and very popular idea. It has spectacular potential experimental signatures. For example, it will imply that in high energy accelerators, you can produce these superparticles. And it also has another very appealing feature, that the lightest supersymmetric particle turns out to be stable, and therefore it can be the dark matter of the universe. In fact, if you estimate the amount of leftover the amount of leftover lightest supersymmetric particles in the universe, just cosmologically, if you estimate them, you find that the abundance of the lightest supersymmetric particles, those that fail to annihilate and are still around today, can easily account for the dark matter of the universe. So that's a very nice story. It implies that the lightest supersymmetric particle has to be electrically neutral and have no strong interactions. If it had either electric charge or strong interactions, and it is the dark matter of the universe, we would have seen that. So it has to be neutral. And this means that it is you cannot observe it very easily. In particular, you cannot directly see it in colliders. So now this is the state. This was the state of affairs. All of this was known since the early 80s. And there was also a prediction in the early 80s. It turns out that the existence of supersymmetric particles changes the way the various coupling constants of the theory, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic coupling constants, change with energy. So that is, in principle, a very interesting difference between the standard model and the supersymmetric standard model. The way the coupling constant change with energy is different, because there is different particles in the spectrum. So now a great deal of excitement happened around 1991. 1991 is the year when LEP, the Ni plus E minus collider at CERN, turned on and produced a huge number of Z bosons that allowed us to measure with great precision the strong, weak, and electromagnetic coupling constants. And of course, we measured them. Let's say this is the strong, weak, and electromagnetic. These are actually the inverse of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic coupling constant square. So these were measured at around 100 GeV with high precision at left. And then if you extrapolate these measured values to high energies using the supersymmetric particle spectrum, it was found that a miracle happens, that the three lines cross at an energy of about 10 to the 16 GeV. So that attracted a great deal of attention, especially because if you do the same exercise for the standard model, again, take the same measured values and extrapolate them using the particle content of the standard model, they don't cross. They miss each other. So this, since the early 90s, the theoretical community, particle physics community, thought that supersymmetry has been around the corner for all these 20-some years, and that we were going to see it maybe at LEP 2, and maybe at the LHC. Alas, this has not yet happened. And I will give you a plot. This is reasonably... Yeah. Absolutely. Exactly. This rests on specific grand unified theories of the SU5 sort, because that defines the relative normalization of the U1 and the non-abelian gauge. That's completely right. Okay. So here are the. This is one of the more depressing transparencies of this talk. So the vertical axis is the swarf masses, the mass of the superpartners of the ordinary quark, and this is the gluino mass, the superpartner of the gluon. And you see this red line. This red line, you have to be all the region below the red line is excluded by experiment. So if you just eyeball this, this means that roughly speaking, supersymmetric particles have to be heavier than something like 2 TeV, maybe 1.5, at least in a plain vanilla model. There are, you can attempt to do variations of this. In most cases, you cannot change these limits by a lot, but you can change them somewhat. So this is the most, this is like the original version of the 1981 supersymmetric standard model. Is quite constrained. If the masses of the supersymmetric particles are 2 TeV instead of the 100 TeV we wanted 2-3 transparencies ago, this means they are 20 times heavier they should be to help the fine-tuning problem. The fine-tuning goes like the square, so this means that these theories are tuned to about, you know, one part in 400 or so, some percent level tuning. So that is the that is indeed now Mina and collaborators quantified this for a very broad class of theories, not just minimal theories, and they got essentially similar conclusion. And the isofine tuning lines, these red lines are isofine tuning. The message is clear, is that given the present limits, things seem to be tuned to less than a percent. So now, I don't want to end with this pessimistic view or less than a percent. After all, if you think of, if you are in the half full category, you say, wow, it's only a percent instead of 32 decimals. That's amazing. So, and that may well be the right point of view. It's just not as untuned as we were hoping. There is, it's also possible to think of non-plane vanilla theories that are automatically very, not very well tuned. I'll just give you a version. I don't want to give a colloquium on this, but I'll just give you simply because I'm, you know, excited about this. I'll just give you one way. So to give you one way that you can attempt to evade these constraints of the LHC, here is a theory. So this, what I'm saying here is fairly general. When at the LHC you collide protons and you produce superpartners. I just happen to call this gluino. And you always produce them in pair in minimal theory. So you produce a pair of gluinos. The gluino is, of course, a heavy particle. Maybe it weighs 1,000 TeV or so. And then it decays. This heavy particle decays to its supersymmetric partner, namely the gluon, which gives you visible particle, gives you gluon jet. And the lighter supersymmetric particles that I just called the gravitino here, but it's essentially a name. It's a neutral, you know, colorless particle that you cannot see in the detector. Okay? So what happens? A heavy particle, in fact, two heavy particles here, decay into a visible energy and invisible. Because the decaying particle is heavy, there is a lot of visible energy going into the gluon. And there is also a lot of missing energy because you don't see the gravitino. So the two key signatures of most standard supersymmetric theories is missing energy and large transverse momentum. This is extremely useful because, and the experimentalists use this a lot to look for supersymmetry. The point is, LHC is a hadron machine, so there is a lot of things happening when protons and protons collide, especially in small angles in the forward direction. There is all of the normal quantum chromodynamic processes. So you tend to want to look in perpendicular directions to look for events that are unique. Let's say a heavy particle was produced and it decays, let's say, roughly isotropically. So there's a lot of stuff coming off in the perpendicular direction. And that's the way. So you put cuts. You exclude all events which don't have a certain degree of perpendicular momentum bigger than something. Okay. So that's usually how you do this. And the search is you look for large transverse momentum invisible particles, and of course there is associated missing energy from invisible particles. And here spectroscopically now I drew the same picture. The gluino emits a gluon and goes into a gravitino, and the typical momentum of the gluon is like of the order of half the gluino mass. Okay, so that is. So these are the standard search. Now imagine the following the following small change in these ideas. Imagine that the gravitino, instead of being a four-dimensional particle, is five-dimensional or ten-dimensional particle. So even though all the ordinary particles, gluino, quarks, etc., live in three dimensions, the gravitino lives in more dimensions and spreads into inside an extra-dimensional space. In that case, the picture changes because a single higher dimensional gravitino is like many four-dimensional gravitinos. There is the so-called Kaluza-Klein tower. In fact, it doesn't. So here is the ground, the lightest four-dimensional gravitino, and these are excited, and this in fact continues. So in that case, the gluino can decay into any one of these gravitinos by emitting a gluon. However, typically, let's say if you have two or more extra dimensions, there is many more heavy gravitinos than light ones. So there is a preference for decaying into the heavier gravitinos. And because you decay in heavier gravitinos, the amount of missing momentum is reduced. And in some cases can go below the experimental cuts. And therefore, in such theories, maybe the supersymmetry was missed for the following ironic reason. Supersymmetry was missed because there were also large extra dimensions inside which there were many gravitinos into which the gluino was decaying with a preference to decay into the heavy one. It's a very funny, ironic evasion. It says that, well, the less we see at the LHC, the more there is actually. Not only do we have supersymmetry, we also have extra dimensions. So it's a bit hard to believe. This is a logical possibility. I wouldn't put all of my retirement money on it, but it is there and will. It decays differently. It decays, but in both cases, it decays promptly. In other words, there wouldn't be a track. It would decay a little more slowly, but it wouldn't make a difference. How rapidly it decays depends on the fundamentals, on details. What's the fundamental quantum gravity scale? Actually, this is a long story. In fact, this is a very... Exactly, the gluon is soft. Exactly. Okay, and this is, people before proposed having accidental degeneracies of, let's say, the gluino and the gravitino in four-dimensional context. If this was very close to there, you would have lost small energy. But this was deemed accidental, tuned, why should two different things be so close, etc. Here there is dynamics. In fact, there is a dynamical reason. It's just that there is many, many gravitinos, many more gravitinos that are heavier than light. So this is one possibility. And
So it is definitely
so all hope is definitely not lost. It's premature to give up on naturalness. And tremendously interesting physics such as SUSY or extra dimensions or perhaps new strong forces could be around the corner. The next 3 years promise to be very exciting. So stay tuned with collider physics. So we'll know more, you know, in 2 or 3 years the story will continue. And it will continue either in favor of naturalness or perhaps we'll find out that naturalness is not the correct criterion. And that would be, well, that would be a very important lesson because naturalness has worked in the past on several occasions in physics. The list is very long, like understanding hydrogen. The hydrogen binding energy is 13 electron volts. The electron mass is, you know, half an MeV, so it's much, much bigger. That hierarchies such as these are very well understood in physics by dynamics, okay? So it would be interesting if we discover that, well, the criterion of naturalness doesn't work for the weak scale. Okay, so much for high energy or big experiments. Now I want to to go to small experiments. Now, here is a picture of the 60 decades of energy or length scale between the Planck scale, which is the shortest distances that we can, our present theoretical ideas can probe, all the way to the whole universe. So there is a vast ocean of energy scales. And what we have explored in this vast ocean of 60 orders of magnitude is just a couple of islands. The last 100 years or so, we've explored the standard model. Here is, and it covers, let's say, roughly 6 orders of magnitude or so. And then there is a small island here, right in the middle of this energy scale. We find dark energy mysteriously right in the middle. And I think, coincidentally, we also find the neutrino masses right in the middle there. So there are these two small islands in this vast ocean. Now, it's possible that that's all there is in the world. It's a bit hard to believe if you have any theoretical inclination. For example, string theory tends to suggest that there is much more happening. There's many, many sectors. And but whatever it is, we've only explored, let's say, 20% of the real estate that's available here. And there is a lot more left to explore. And some of it is theoretically very well motivated. For example, even in the standard model, we expect to see things. We expect to see gravitons. At least we expect to see gravitational wave radiation, more precisely from, let's say, black holes. And things falling into the black hole. Or we would like to see cosmic neutrinos. This is the primordial cosmic neutrino radiation, which is very challenging because they're very low energy. They're, you know, the energy corresponds to a couple of degrees or so. So that's a challenge. But there are interesting particles even within the standard model that we're seeing. Of course, seeing gravitational waves goes way beyond the interesting. If we have gravitational wave observation, then eventually that will lead to gravitational wave observatory. So we'll be looking at the universe with a completely new eye. And it will be staggeringly different than what we see. We'll see much deeper. We'll look very different. And that will be amazing. That's something that will happen. It may take 100 years, a few hundred years, but we will have... We will be able to see the universe with gravitational eye. Then in string theory, there is a number of particles. Axions in general are very well motivated. Now, in particular, the QCD axion is perhaps the best motivated particle beyond the standard model. It solves the strong CP problem, and it's also a very good dark matter candidate. So searches, a lot of the searches for new particles focus on actions as well as gravitons through new gravitational wave detectors. Then there is other possibilities. Photons that are kinetically mixed with our photon that Natalia and Philip have done pioneering work on. That's a very interesting sector to explore. And dilatons, moduli, they are particles that may exist. New dimensions of space. All of these, the list probably continues. And so many interesting possibilities. So how do you probe the low energy frontier?
Well, this is not. This is already happening. There are experiments for which already happening.
The, you know, the one that is about to turn on is called Advanced LIGO, and that will look for gravitational waves.
Then there is other ongoing experiment. Both of these that I drew here is axion searches.
This is called photons through a wall. A photon goes through a wall by first converting into axion, and then the axion reconverts into photon. So searches for axions by having photon through all experiments have been going on. This is a picture of ADMX. This is the experiment where if the axion is the dark matter, then in the presence of strong magnetic field, it can create electric field. So it's probing that aspect of the axion. And this has been ongoing at the University of Washington for a while. And then there is other experiments that are not yet online. Actually, this is almost online. This is atom interferometric experiment that promised to test all of these things, promised to test Einstein's theory, provide, you know, look for electric dipole moments, etc. Then there is experiments that have been going on. Actually, this has already happened and it is being improved. This is a test of short distance gravity and the existence of extra dimension by using cantilevers. So small cantilevers, these are like, you know, tens of micron, little diving boards, tens of micron large, and they have characteristic frequencies. So if you bring a mass at a frequency equal to their characteristic frequency, you can resonantly excite. This, and Aaron Kapitulnik in particular at Stanford has been doing that. This is one of Mina's proposals. Optically levitated objects can be used to as a gravitational wave detection at higher frequencies, short range, looking for new short range forces. And then there is axion field detection using nuclear magnetic resonance. What I will do, there is a lot more. This is just a relatively small selection. There are experiments, for example, Adelberger does to test short distance gravity. Just brilliant experiments that that have been going on for at least a decade or more. Again, to look for deviations at short distances. Short means, you know, 30 microns, 40 microns, or less. So, for example, a normalization, gravity has been measured, the force of to be normal Einsteinian gravity, normal Newtonian gravity, down to distances of about 50 microns now. So going towards 1 micron is one next pioneering step that many of these people like Adelberger and Kapitulnik are, and this experiment of Minas and Andy Geraci will be trying to do. So today I'll just talk about a couple of these. I'll talk about atom interferometry, and I'll talk about axion field detection. Okay, let me start with atom interferometry, and the simplest way to start is by analogy with light interferometry. So in light interferometry, let's say you have a photon. You split the wave function of a single photon by a beam splitter to a beam splitter to a path that goes
to the right and a path that goes up. So beam splitter splits the wave function of a photon in two, then and the mirrors recombine the two components of the wave function of the photon. They go through another beam splitter, and then you measure interference patterns in these output ports. So this is a classic interferometer. The accuracy of the measurement is related to the wave function of light, to the wavelength of light divided by the size of the experiment. Okay? Because if you change if you change anything, if there is any difference in the physics that is encountered in the upper trajectory versus the lower trajectory, that will lead to a fringe shift in the output point. Okay, this is the accuracy of the measurement. For atoms, essentially exactly the same idea, except in space-time, instead of having x-axis and y-axis, both space, you have x-axis, which is in fact the height, in the case of the experiment I'll talk about, and then time. Okay, so it's instead of being space-space, it is time-space. So here, this picture here describes the following experiment that, let's say, Mark Kasevich is doing now in the basement of the laboratory at Stanford. You take an atom, rubidium-87 atom, and you launch it. You launch it, and then through a beam splitter laser sequence, you split the wave function of the atom into a fast-moving and a slow-moving component. So this one moves fast, let's say it gets kicked by the photon, this does not. Okay. Then you apply two mirror pulses that exchange. The slow becomes fast and the fast becomes slow, so that the two components of the wave of function of the atom recombine, they go through another beam splitter, and you read off at the output port. So the experiment happens vertically. You launch the atom, then you apply the sequence of pulses, beam splitter, mirror, beam splitter, and then you look at the interference pattern at the end. Again, the idea is the following. If there is any difference in the physics of the upper trajectory versus the lower trajectory, this will manifest itself as a fringe shift. For example, if in the upper trajectory you encountered, let's say an extra massive particle. Let's say there is some lead ball that one path of the wave function encounters, but not the other. That could be registered as a shift. Okay. Now, what's the difference between light and atoms? And the difference comes out. You can explain it in two different ways. In terms of interferometers, the point is that when you do atom interferometry, atoms move very slowly. This means that the experiment can last for a long time. In the case of Mark Kasevich's experiment, he has a 10-meter tower. It takes about a second for a particle to move, to drop 10 meters. So the experiment that he has lasts for a full second. So if you convert to a corresponding space-space interferometer, it would have to be a very long interferometer, because 1 second corresponds to a distance from here to the moon. And that gives you leverage. Another way of saying the same thing is that if these two experiments have the same size, this one lasts much longer, because it takes a second for these heavy particles to move 10 meters. And therefore, you have more time to accumulate phase shift differential if there is any difference in the physics of the upper and the lower trajectory. And the more you can separate the distance, this is the distance of maximum separation between the wave function of the atom. Okay, so the atom splits its wave function, this is the distance of maximum. The bigger you can make that distance, the more the precision of your experiment. Oops, sorry. Yeah. Okay, so, as of a few months ago, I haven't been to Stanford since August, so the latest I had heard was that the maximum wave packet separation, here it says 4 centimeters. This was outdated. It was more like 8 centimeters. And now, given their pace of progress, maybe they went to more. And so that eventually, what would they like to do? They would like to separate the two components of the wave function of the atom by a few meters. If they can do 7 meters, 8 meters, anything up to 10. The more the better. It's like creating what's called a Schrödinger cat state of the atom that's very big. Okay. And then you can do all kinds of experiments. Once the two components of the wave function of the atom get separated by a lot, you can have different physics for the top component of the wave function on the bottom, which, as I said, put a lead ball or do something in the upper part of the trajectory that the lower part does not see, and then you can pick up. Then can be a frequency that will measure or detect such a force. So what is happening at the moment with the Stanford experiment is the first thing. Yes, of course. Yes, they do. On the other hand, they are not. Maybe they are at 8 centimeters. Maybe they are a bit more. They would like to separate more. Now what they are doing is the following. They want to test right now that the very first physics objective they have is to test the equivalence principle. Okay? So Galileo tested it by dropping, well, from the Tower of Pisa, whatever. This is the imaginary axis. He really did it by inclined planes, but this makes a much better story. So he was dropping, let's say, coins and billiard balls from the Tower of Pisa and seeing if they drop at the same rate. So he tested it by, you know, order one. The experiments that Mark Kasevich and Jason Hogan are aiming at are, to start with, they want to reach 10 to minus 15, and then eventually 10 to minus 17. For comparison, the present best test of the equivalence principle, one of them, is based on laser lunar ranging, which measures the fact that the Earth and the Moon fall towards the Sun at the same rate. And you can monitor the relative motion of the Earth and the Moon because a very early astronaut, I don't know who it was, put some corner cube, an object that if you shine light, it comes straight back to you. So you're continuously laser ranging the relative position of the Earth and the Moon, and anyway, that test has reached the precision of 3 × 10⁻³. Here, the first version of that Mark and Jason are going to aim at is 15 decimals, and then they think they'll go to 17 with no problem. What are they doing for this purpose? You need two things to test the equivalence principle, so they put Rubidium 85 and 87. Now they are putting the second rubidium in their apparatus. So they will be launching rubidium 85 and 87 atoms. And then they'll be testing the degree to which they fall at the same rate. And that's the stage they are at. As of a week ago, I was, that's what I was informed. So now you can also test the theory of general relativity. And you can test correction beyond Newton. According to Newton, the acceleration is the gradient of the potential. But there are non-linearities in gravity. In particular, gravity gravitates. This means, the particle physicist language, this means that the graviton, there is a free graviton couple. So the graviton gravitates. This means gravitational energy can gravitate, and you can measure that. For example, this is an interesting story. The gravitational energy as a fraction of the total energy in, let's say, the Earth or the Moon is 1 × 10⁻¹. Okay, so the gravitational self-energy is 1 × 10⁻¹ of the total mass of the object. Directly related to the escape velocity. But the equivalence principle is tested to 10 to minus 13. This means that we have tested the statement that gravitational energy has a weight
to about 3 parts in 1,000. So that's amazing. This means that we know the 3-graviton coupling to be the same as the coupling of graviton to matter to about 3 parts per 1,000. This is better precision than we know the 3-gluon coupling, which involves strong interaction. So this is the level at which these experiments are amazing, and because they're studying such a weak force, but with big objects. Now, that's the non-linearity of gravity. This is another, again, GR effect, the statement that if you have an object and you move it, its kinetic energy gravitates. Now, so this we'll also be able to measure. Of course, both of these effects contribute to the precession of mercury, perihelion, etc. It's not like they'll be measured for the first time, but it will be fun that information testing GR, which was thought to be exclusively doable by having big objects, planets around stars, etc., can now be studied by studying the motion of atoms in the gravitational field of the Earth. So, Neil? Oh, there are several terms of this form. In the Lagrangian, yes. Yes, you can put that in, yes. But in the Newton's theory gives you the first term. Right, and the other things are GR corrections. And that's all. I'm saying that the theory of GR already produces these 2 terms. And by the way, I mean, this is an impressionistic way of writing. There are coefficients here. And there is also more than one such term where... Okay. So that's one thing that is on the horizon. Testing the equivalence principle. Hopefully we'll be on a time scale of maybe 1 or 2. I've been saying this for a long time. So, in fact, since 2006 and 7. But now it seems like there is, since they're putting both rubidium 85 and 87 in the same tube, I'm more optimistic. they'll start on a longer time scale testing general relativity. Another very, very exciting application is to build a gravitational wave detector using atom interferometry. The idea is somewhat long. I'll just give you the essence of the idea. You take 2 interferometers. One is here. I was talking before about 10-meter interferometers, which exist already. Now here you can take 10 or 100-meter interferometers. So you're doing and you separate them by 1,000 kilometers. And you have a series of laser pulses that essentially monitor the motion of atoms on the left and the right interferometer. So the atoms on the left, you monitor the relative motion of atoms on the left and on the right. Now, the idea is that if a gravitational wave comes inside the slide, moving this way, it will jolt space, it will jolt the distance between the 2 atoms, and that will be registered. And this proposal goes back to 2008. For the last 3 years, there has been a great deal of interest from a variety of sources. In particular, NASA has a grant investigating this concept. And my colleagues, Peter Graham and Kasevich and Fogel and Rajendran, are all involved in this study. But a lot of NASA people have strong interest in this. So that's, they are thinking about how they might launch some satellite program that involves this interferometer. There is another underground experiment. Underground is somewhat better than the surface and the Earth because it's a little more quiet. So you can have a smaller version
of this experiment. Now, the underground experiment is not 1,000 kilometers long, it's only 1 kilometer. So you can have 2 10-meter interferometers separated by kilometers and study higher frequency gravitational waves. And Philippe Boyer, who is in France, he spent a couple of years in the laboratory with Jason Hogan and Mark Kasevic. So he is now working somewhere under the vineyards of Bordeaux. It is a laboratory. It's a mine, and I would very much like to go visit him there. And here is, I hope so, here is the sensitivity, here is frequency, here is the sensitivity. This is, again, this is self-explanatory. This is what advanced LIGO will do. They'll do wonderful things at higher frequencies. There has been a long-standing proposal for LISA, which if constructed, it will go to low frequencies. And this proposal that will go all ages, this is the one that NASA is studying now. But this is the one that we, the sort of somewhat more ambitious version. That's a very ambitious version. And that, so the sensitivity can get quite good. So this is all for the future. I didn't have time to say, if you compare the size of these proposed ages, as I said, the separation between the interferometer is 1,000 kilometers. LISA separation is 5 million kilometers. So it's a very different, and part of it has to do with what we were saying before. Light moves fast, so you need very big distances to study a given period, a gravitational wave. But atoms are slower, so you can make a more compact interferometer. So summary, so the equivalence principle, so there is a lot of work going on in atom interferometry, and perhaps the most exciting long-term perspective, at least from my point of view, is to think of building gravitational wave detector. It will be awesome if it starts in our lifetime towards a gravitational wave observatory. Now I will move so much for atom interferometry. Now I'll move to axion detection, just another experimental idea. Mina already gave a very nice overview of this, so I'll be a little bit faster. So the axion, for the students among you, the axion is an extremely well-motivated particle in the standard model. The standard model as it stands has a problem which is called the strong CP problem, namely in the standard model you would expect the electric dipole moment of the neutron to be a large number. And in reality, some parameter has to be quite small, of the order of 10 to minus 10, to explain the fact that we have not measured electric dipole moment for elementary particles, for the neutron in particular. Now, there is a brilliant solution to this problem proposed back in 78, which is essentially to make this parameter a dynamical variable. And the pioneers of that proposal argued that if it's a dynamical variable, then they showed that it can adjust itself to go to near zero, thereby explaining dynamically the smallness of this number. Converting this parameter can be converted to a dynamical variable, which comes by the name of the axion. Okay, so the axion therefore is a particle. It has a mass and a coupling that are related by this expression. The important number to keep in mind here is that the axion is a very light particle. For example, it's a sort of preferred ranges for the mass of the axion can range from 3 kilometers to 3 centimeters. These are all very big Compton wavelengths for an elementary particle. So it's a very light elementary particle. And the quantity F that I will use is just called the axion decay constant. And okay. Now, the axion does two things that are interesting if you want to observe it. The first thing is that because it's a light particle, it can mediate forces. It can mediate forces between two masses. Even if they are unmagnetized masses, if they have spins,
And so they can, in either case, whether two masses are magnetized or unmagnetized, they can feel axion forces, forces that are mediated by axion. That's one effect. So axion mediates forces. And because its mass is so low, it mediates forces at macroscopic distances. The second thing that the axion can do that's by no means obvious from what I said is that the axion field now, think of it as a field, not as a particle, can be oscillating in the universe today, and that oscillation carries energy, and that oscillation can be the source of the what's called the dark matter of the universe. So the axion particle, the axion can be the dark matter, can provide the dark matter of the universe. So by using these two features of the axion, one can build experiments that, again, I don't have time to describe here. I think Nina described the second experiment a week ago. One experiment, the idea of these experiments is the following: to use NMR. NMR, now it turns out that axions couple to spins. Okay? And if they couple to a single spin, well, that's no big deal. There is not much of an effect. The axion is a very weak force, so it will affect the spin a little bit. And you can't easily measure the effects of that. However, if you have an Avogadro's number of spins, such as in an NMR sample, then all of the spins can start rotating together under the influence of the axion, and that can cause a measurable change in the magnetic field that is caused by these spins, by these rotating spins, and that magnetic, time-dependent magnetic field can be picked up by a squid magnetometer. So that's the general idea, and I don't want to go into details. In one proposal, you use the fact that the axion is a time-dependent field whose energy makes up the dark matter of the universe. If the axion is time-dependent field, neutrons, for example, get time-dependent electric dipole moments, which can precess inside the intrinsic internal electric fields of atoms. And if you have a big sample, you can see this precession. And Mina's proposal was, if you have an axion, the gradient of the axion field acts like a magnetic field inside which the nuclear spins precess. So by looking at the precession of nuclear spins in the presence of a mass, in the presence of a mass, the precession caused by the mass, by the axion field on the spin can again be picked up by a squid. Okay, the range, this is quite exciting for the following reason. Here is the axion parameter space. F is this axion decay constant that I introduced 2 slides ago. In the gray region, axion can be a dark matter candidate. And now, astrophysical bounds and have excluded the red region on the left, and black hole superradiant has excluded the axion, and I'm talking about the QCD axion region on the right. Here is a region that is varied by if, for example, you have a stage of very high scale inflation, that would be a region that is favored. It's this region is the region that can be probed in the near future by looking for black holes of lower mass, whether they are superradiating or not, whether they are rapidly rotating or not. And and the cosmic axion NMR and the axion exchange NMR experiment, the two that I described in the previous slides, cover this area and this area. Now there is a gap in the axion parameter space that's challenging. So as of what
20 hours ago. Mina thinks she has an idea on how to probe the axiom here, but I will wait to hear from her before I announce it in public. So let me now close by summarizing the second part of my discussion. So there is a lot of experiments and experimental ideas that have not yet become experiments that are scattered around the globe. They are typically, you know, in a single institution, like some at Stanford, some at Washington, et cetera. And so they are looking for foundational physics, fundamental physics for action, for gravitational waves, electric dipole moments, etc., and many other things. Now, these experiments have two features. First, they are isolated from each other. So the experimentalists that are involved in these experiments don't have the benefit of interacting with each other. And they also usually don't have the benefit of interacting with theorists. The second point is that often these experiments are very hard to get funded. Why? Because they fall in the cracks of funding agencies. So for example, it's not clear if, let's say Aaron Capitone's experiment, because I know the story, he was looking for extra dimensions, you know, sub-millimeter-sized extra dimensions. That was his objective. So that sounds like particle physics or string theory. But his techniques were condensed matter physics. He was using cantilevers and micro-machining technology. And so for 5 years, he was trying to get funding, but you know, neither agency was willing to do it until, anyway, things happened. But and part of it has to do with, because this field of doing foundational experiments with any experimental method is not yet on the radar screen. So the question is there any virtue to housing all these experiments, many such experiments, in one home? And so let's give it a name, let's say super lab for physics. So what do I mean by super lab for fundamental physics? Well, I mean the following. First, it has to be, it's a laboratory that houses lots of small scale experiments. I would say at least 20 for a nice big threshold number. And what do I mean by fundamental physics? Well, what I mean is what a particle physicist thinks about fundamental physics, namely the search for new forces, new particles, new dimension, truly new phenomena beyond the standard model phenomena. Very important, such a laboratory should be open to any promising experimental technique. Its objective is foundational physics, open to absolutely any experimental technique. And ideally, the vision would be that it functions in the high energy physics model of a big laboratory like Fermilab or CERN, where there is brilliant local personnel and also a large fraction of, to a large extent, it acts as a user facility. So people in any place, in any university that have brilliant ideas, make a proposal to a board, to an advisory board, and if the proposal is approved, then they get time to do their experiment, let's say for 5 years or so, for some finite but reasonably long time scale at that super lab. So is there a value to doing that? Well, so here is possible answers to this question. First of all, there are physics opportunities coming together with that. Having such a laboratory would have intrinsic value in the same sense that Plato conceived when he established the Academy of Athens, which is the first university. So having smart people under the same roof with common interests
can do miracles. Okay? You get coherent effects and you have tremendously accelerated knowledge. So I think these brilliant experimentals that are now isolated, if they can have a chance to come together at least for a fraction of the year and interact on such experiments, I think miracles can happen. Then shared lab resources. There is lack of duplication. This could be a top level facility, best machines, best support staff, and brilliant local scientists, etc. So there could be a lot of shared lab resources. And there is also a virtue that is a bit hard to define, but having foundational science independent of the experimental technique, whether it's colliders or small-scale experiments, as a recognized field is very valuable. For one thing, young people can decide to go into foundational science and study it. It's very important to have a name, to be identified with something. So such a laboratory would contribute to defining this new field, which, after all, is the way physics was going on until the period, until the 50s, until after the war. There was no, just colliders was one way to do physics, but there were a lot of ideas involving small-scale experiments. You know, Fermi didn't just think about colliders. This was, in a sense, broadening foundational or fundamental physics to include small-scale experiments is going back to the norm of what it used to be before the war. Of course, after the war, we got tremendous resources, so we could all focus on, you know, on colliders. But now, I think it is interesting to contemplate this. There may have been missed physics opportunities because we haven't been pursuing small-scale experiments for a while. Then there is sociological opportunities, which are also very important. First of all, these experiments are not expensive. Many of them would be very happy to have like $250,000 per year. And how expensive is your proposal with Andy? For 3 years. So this is a sort of timescale for looking at the action in that window of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 11, 12. So you can get a single donor, and it's a normal donor. It's not like you need Bill Gates to support the LHC. That he may be the only person who could support a collider. But here, private funding can have big impact. For example, if you can discover the action with 1 million, that would be amazing. This would have similar impact to discovering the Higgs, which costed 10 billion. They are both very important. I don't want to divide by the number of dollars and draw any conclusions. But what I'm saying is that there is a tremendous opportunity for foundational discoveries there. There is also another potential advantage, new vision for investing public resources. And this is very important, and it has been somewhat overlooked. For example, big accelerators that are, let's say, that stop colliding particles. That is, even if they use a small fraction of their resources to support such an effort, a small experiment, that would make a big difference because the cost of the experiments is so small. An obvious place is CERN. CERN could have a very tiny fraction of their budget devoted to such experiments, which would go a long way. And I think what's another thing that's very important is to keep young talent in the field. So to keep, independent of how great the LHC results are, after a few years, I can imagine a situation where the next collider will be, you know, a couple of decades away, and smart young people want to be happy and they want to feel relevant and excited. And for that, it's important to have experiments whose time scale is like 5 years instead of 30 or 40 years. So for all these reasons, I think this may be a good idea to pursue. So to end on a summary note, so there are the last 50 years we witnessed exponential growth in fundamental physics, mainly driven by colliders. I think the next 50 years will be at least as exciting, and they will be driven by a combination of colliders and brilliant new ideas on small-scale experiments. Thank you.
Okay, questions?
Are you not troubled by the fact that, when you go to a supersymmetric model, there could be as many as 123 parameters?
Yes, absolutely. So the question was, the question was if I am discouraged by the fact that in supersymmetry there is many parameters that are not specified by the theory. These are, roughly speaking, additional. There's roughly 100 additional parameters beyond the standard model. Yes, if you write a bare-bones supersymmetric theory, this is correct. But the moment you start being specific about how supersymmetry is broken, the dynamics that is involved in the breaking of supersymmetry, the number of parameters is tremendously reduced to a handful, for example. If you have something called gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking, the number of parameters is reduced quite a bit. There is still more parameters than the standard model, but maybe there is 10 more and not 100 more.
Next question.
So, I'm wondering, are there recent successful examples of tabletop experiments which aim to probe fundamental physics, or is it just there hasn't been that many recently, and there are proposals, but they're not being implemented because of funding issues?
You mean examples of this? Yes, I'll give you
yes.
an example. They actually, let's say Mark Kasevich and experiment and Jason Hogan's experiment at Stanford that is happening. It is not funded. It is not funded as a fundamental physics experiment. That experiment is scraping money from research that is funded by DOD, Department of Defense, DOE, and NSF. And in particular, because DOD is a very big funder of this effort, because they are interested in gravimeters and accelerometers, they are interested in all kinds of applied things for mapping mass distributions, what's called something called ship container characterization, how you can characterize the mass distribution inside the ship container by doing these gravitational experiments, or looking for caves in Afghanistan, etc. So there is a lot of money that is. That experiment is officially not a funded experiment. The first people who are thinking of who are funding aspects of that experiment just now started NASA, the last 3 or 2 years. But it's, they are focused on the gravitational waves. Mark is doing the equivalence principle, testing Einstein's theory, looking for new forces that are, or testing electric neutrality of atoms. None of these things are funded. And Aaron Kapitulnik, for about 5 years, he was doing the experiment again without funding. It was scraping resources from his condensed matter experiment and using equipment, and having students work part-time on this. It's really quite heroic.
Next question.
Have you discussed your idea of the super lab with lab directors in the U.S. and do you have an idea of what the annual budget for such a lab would be?
No, I have not discussed it, and perhaps I should, and I have not. Well, this is getting on this. I'll make some general comments. CERN is very committed to the LHC. And at the moment, I don't think they view themselves as having free money on this. And I think similarly, Fermilab is committed to their neutrino program. SLAC has their own program that has been in place. So it may be almost too late. Could be, depending on what happens with the LHC, could be that more interest will happen. You know, let's say in 5-10 years, there could be a transition into such a mode of operation. But I have not discussed it.
Are there any further questions? OK, then let's thank the speaker again.